This is UN and Africa from the United Nations in New York. I'm Matthew Wells. In this week's programme, comprehensive sex education in Uganda's classrooms is vital to help stop HIV in its tracks, one local activist tells us, and a major funding boost from Canada to provide cash transfers to thousands of Congolese refugees in western Tanzania. We'll have the details. But first, the peaceful transition of power in The Gambia to President Adama Barrow is clear evidence that preventive diplomacy works. That's according to Mohamed Ibn Chambas, head of the UN's Office of West Africa and the Sahel, who was a key figure in resolving the political crisis there, alongside regional leaders in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, and the African Union. Former President Yahya Jammeh eventually agreed to leave after 22 years in power. I asked Mr. Chambas what it had been like in the capital, Banjul, for the new president's arrival.
I got to Banjul and it was an incredibly exhilarating atmosphere at the airport. You could see the excitement and the high expectation on all the people that were there to welcome their president home, and a sense of history in the making too. So I was just very pleased, very, very happy to be part of that moment.
And how important has the role of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, been during this whole crisis?
Oh, no, there's no question that it's been key to finding a political and a peaceful resolution to it. The ECOWAS has been resolute in insisting on the respect of its protocol on democracy and good governance, insisted from the beginning that elections should be conducted in an atmosphere which would be conducive to free and fair, credible elections.
What can you tell us about the process of persuading former President Jammeh to leave, and what were the key factors that allowed you and ECOWAS and other heads of state to pave the way for this ultimately peaceful transfer of power that's occurred?
I think first and foremost was the fact that the ECOWAS, working with the UN and the African Union, had mobilized the wider international community, including in particular the UN Security Council, to be united in supporting the principled position that the president who had lost the election should step down. On this, absolute unanimity was achieved, and there was not a single dissenting voice. Beyond that, as you know, the ECOWAS also took a firm position to enforce their decision in asking President Jammeh to step down and to allow for a peaceful transition, barring which they were willing to use all necessary means.
What does President Barrow's return to his country mean for the UN and the role of international diplomacy in Africa overall? I mean, many will see this as a watershed moment.
I think that this is clear evidence of the efficacy of preventive diplomacy. We did everything working together, the UN and all the other partners, especially the regional partners, prevent Gambia from becoming yet another crisis country on the continent, where we regrettably have enough crisis to deal with. And I think today we can all be proud that we are proving that when we stand together, we speak with one voice.
Comprehensive sex education programs are important to stop the spread of HIV among young people, a program director for the Ugandan Network of Young Positives has said. Nicholas Niwagaba, who is also a member of the UNAIDS network called ACT 2015, spoke on the margins of the Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, Youth Forum at UN headquarters. Mr. Niwagaba talked to Jocelyn Sambira about his organization's efforts to encourage young people to get tested.
The key message that we are preaching out there to many of the young people is go out there, test for HIV, know your HIV status, and if you're not, make sure you really protect yourself. And if you are HIV positive, it's not the end of it all. So you still can enroll on medication, still live a healthy life.
Knowing your status is one thing, but once you do, are the services out there, and are there services that the young people can access?
That's a very interesting question, because some controversial discussions that we are having at the country level, where the government is saying we cannot have comprehensive sexuality education out there in the school. And I think it's a big, big worry. You know, the concern is, what do we mean when we say comprehensive? We are not asking our children out there in school to go and have sex, no. But we are trying to give them the basic information on how they can protect themselves. And you know, the sex debate is high, and the median sex of age encounter, most young people start sex at 11, 14. So when we shy away and we deny them the right to access information about their sexual reproductive health, I think we are doing a disservice, and we may not end AIDS by 2030 if they are not having the information. But again, one of the things that we are focusing on as the Country Alliance for Act 2015 Uganda chapter, we are looking at how do we make sure that we have youth-friendly services for the young people.
Uganda was once a success story in terms of fighting HIV/AIDS.
Sure.
And today it seems that things have changed, but not for the better. Is that true? And what do you feel is the reason?
Yes, I will agree with you. Uganda made history in one of the countries, I think, in the early 90s on curbing the new HIV infection, because we registered high new HIV infections, related death, but we were able to curb them down. But progress. But I think down the road, we kind of felt like everything was done, and we took back and relaxed in the seats. And I think we are really doing a little bit bad, because if you look in sub-Saharan Africa, we're still on top of the table. High new HIV infection, we're still having youth and adolescents disproportionately affected by HIV. And I think we should remember those days, go back to our roots, remember the approaches we use in the first places, and we can, I definitely believe we can still combat the epidemic.
A $385,000 contribution from Canada is being used by the World Food Programme, WFP, to provide cash transfers to thousands of Congolese refugees in western Tanzania. The pilot programme at the Nyaragusu refugee camp will give households the freedom to purchase items at a nearby market, which will also inject money into the local economy. Under the three-month scheme, 10,000 refugees will receive twice-monthly transfers of $4.50 to their mobile phones, as well as food. Stella Vuzzo spoke to Saidi Johari, head of WFP's office in Kasulu, located in the Kigoma region of Tanzania.
The objective of the program is to enable refugees to diversify their food and also to boost the local economy at large. During pilot phase, we are going to cover 10,000 individuals, and we are expecting to reach 50,000 by mid of the year and 100,000 by end of the year.
And how are you planning to transfer that money to the refugees in the camps?
We don't expect any insecurity-related issues, because the money is being transferred to their mobile phone, and they will be withdrawing depending on what time they want to spend the money.
Is there any other support that you're providing to the refugees besides the cash transfer? And how much are we talking about to each of these 10,000 refugees?
Yeah, we're expecting for each 10,000 refugees, the transfer value will be 20,000 per person per month. And then the amount will cover to buy 5 commodities: a maize meal, pulses, and salt, vegetable, and fish. And also, WFP will continue providing in-kind for 2 commodities: oil and soybeans.
And why have you decided to have this option now and not any time earlier?
Cash-based transfer is a market intervention. In Nyarugusu camp, for instance, Congolese have been there for more than 20 years. And then WFP has been provided them with the same kind of commodities. So we thought that this is the right time for them to enable them to procure food around the villages, to enable them to procure food of their preference, and to enable also to boost the local economy.
You have been working in the camps for a long time, and you're talking about the Congolese being there for over 20 years. Briefly explain to our listeners, what do the refugees do inside the camps? What happens inside there? Do they just sit down? Is there any activity? What kind of things, what kind of life do they live in there?
The government policy or internment policy that the refugees are not allowed to go outside the camp. Inside the camp, they are doing small kitchen agriculture, kitchen gardening, producing vegetables, and also they are doing some handicraft and small business. So So most of them, or most of the time, they depend on the WFP support.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of UN and Africa. You can follow more of our programmes at radio.un.org, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Matthew Wells.